We'll pick up from where we left off yesterday. Genesis chapter 2, and we now come to a development of the point that we saw in chapter 1 concerning the creation of man. In chapter 2 it goes over this point, and I did discuss many of these matters yesterday. Commencing at verse 4, it tells us that the world, originally, was not as we know it today, but it was gradually prepared by God, stage by stage, till it became a fitting place for man to dwell. We are then told how God made man, and he made man out of materials that he had made previously. Once man is made, God then puts him into a garden where man is to serve the days of his probation, you might say, his apprenticeship, where he's going to learn, where God is going to test and train him. That garden is probably better understood as some sort of parkland. We mustn't think of it as a garden in the sense of a garden we have in our front yard. I guess the nearest equivalent we'd have today would be to call it something like a national park. It's some sort of parkland that's set off from the rest of the country. It's found in a region called Eden. It's only part of Eden. And that Eden itself is in a place somewhere in the Mesopotamian Valley. Let us note at the outset that this paradise, these conditions of paradise that we're familiar with, are confined to this parkland. Don't get the idea that the world was one great paradise. It wasn't. It's only in this garden that you have the perfect conditions. Outside this garden, the world was still untamed. And God placed man in this parkland to test and to train him. And then as man developed and as he multiplied, so he was able, hopefully, to move out from this parkland and then bring the rest of the untamed creation outside under his control. That again is referred to in the key verses that I mentioned yesterday in chapter 1, verses 27 and 28, where man is made in the image of God. And then in verse 28, he is to be fruitful and to multiply and to fill the earth and subdue it. The earth was not subdued. It was only the garden where man was placed, there in Eden. That was paradise. The rest of the world still had to be tamed, and man was to do this as he proved himself in the garden. As he multiplied, his numbers became greater, and then he was to spread out and bring the remainder of the creation under control. Now we know the story that what happened was that man himself fell into sin, and instead of Eden, or instead of the garden, or paradise, spreading out to the rest of the world, what happened was the rest of the world spread into paradise, and so paradise was lost. And the place went back to jungle. And creation, which was to enter its full glory with man, failed to enter that full glory, as we're told in Romans chapter 8. And it awaits the return of Jesus Christ, when man will be fully redeemed, and then creation will enter its full glory, as was intended in the first place. Well, we come to this point again about the image of God. And I mentioned yesterday that because man was made in the image of God, he therefore has to make some sort of response to God. He is a responsible being. This image, man in the image of God, I like to think of it as an illustration, for example, of, let us say, the moon and the image of the moon upon the water. Now you can have a moon without the image, but you can't have the image without the moon. God can exist without man, but man cannot exist without God. It's the image of God in man that makes man, man. So man cannot be independent of God. That's the whole point of it. Man is dependent upon God. The image of the moon cannot exist independently of the moon. It depends upon the moon. Man cannot exist independently of God. Man depends upon God. And it's because of this that God set a limit to the freedom which he gave man. To give man complete freedom would not have been compatible with man's creation as being in the image of God. We'll come to that more particularly as we get on to chapter 3. But firstly, let us note that because man was a responsible being, made in the image of God, he is then given the opportunity to develop the various potentialities that God placed within him. I touched very briefly yesterday on the fact that an animal more or less keeps on doing the same things year in, year out, and is perfectly content. A man is not content that way because there is within man something that is not in any other animal. There is within man the spark of the eternal, something which only the eternal can satisfy. And that's why it is that man progresses and wants to keep on going and reaching out after more and more things. Well, God recognized this, and so when he placed man in this parkland, he gave him the opportunities to develop the potentialities within him. Physical development, for example, he was able, in verse 15, or he was supposed to keep the garden, till the ground, and so on. Work was not a result of the fall. Work was there before man sinned. It was the pain that came from work which resulted from man's sin, and I'll touch on that later on. As I said previously, he was to subdue the earth. He was to bring the untamed world outside under his control. Again, the opportunity for physical development within man. In verse 9, it talks about the different types of fruit that God allowed him to eat. As he chose some sorts of fruit and rejected others and made himself various meals, so he developed his abilities in the physical realm. Move on to the development of man's mind. In verse 17, he is given a choice, the powers of choice, not only to choose the foods which he wanted to eat, but also he had to refuse certain fruits which he was not allowed to eat. And as he exercised this choice, so he developed his mental abilities. You find there was the opportunity there for artistic appreciation also in verse 9. The fruit was not only good for food, but also pleasant to the sight. So here man can look at things and appreciate their beauty. And so you can see the development that's going on here as his various capacities are to be developed. In verse 15, as he tills the garden, as he keeps it, as he trims things, looks after flowers and trees or whatever it was there, he's developing his appreciation of the arts of beauty and the various other things which help to develop our minds. You find also there's a social development, and in verse 18, the man is told that it is not good that he should be alone. And so now we find that man has a woman as his counterpart, as his companion, and the two of them can answer to each other. We have to develop socially. We don't live by ourselves. We have to relate to other people. This again is part of the development and the training as God deals with early man. And then there's the spiritual development, the tree of life mentioned in verse 9. Communion with God, which is again talked about in chapter 3, God walking in the garden and wanting to commune with these people. And so there's the opportunity now for the development of his spiritual capacities. Physical, mental, social, spiritual. All these things are there so that as man is placed in this environment in the garden, it's the time of his testing and training. But we know the story, if we've read it previously, that man rebelled against God. We then come to this matter of the two trees. That is the tree of life and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Please, let us not get bogged down with discussions on horticulture, arguing over whether it was a cherry tree, an apple tree, an orange tree, or anything like that. And let us not get the idea that the trees were magical in some way. That's not the point of the story. It doesn't really matter, as far as I can see, whether you take the trees literally or figuratively. Certainly, what we're talking about is historical fact. Whether it's presented to us in some sort of pictorial, stylized form or otherwise, is really not a matter of great importance, because the meaning is the same whichever way you look at it. Some people find it difficult to believe that these are literal trees. You can weigh out 2 kilos of apples. It's not very easy to weigh out 2 kilos of the knowledge of good and evil. Whether you take them as literal trees or whether it's a figurative way of expressing what happened there in Eden, it makes no difference whatever. Because these two trees teach us what was happening in the relationship between God and man. That tree of the knowledge of good and evil, which was forbidden to man, as it stood there forbidden, it presented man with an alternative to God. The tree of life stood there as what God wanted man to partake of. He was to partake of that. God wanted him to partake of that. God said, "You are not to partake of this." The meaning of it is something like this. God wants man to enjoy the fullness of true spiritual life. He wants him to partake of the tree of life. But man must do so in accordance with his status as being made in God's image. And his status as being made in God's image is that he has no absolute right to do as he wishes. He has no absolute right to determine what is good and what is evil. God alone is the one who decides what is good and what is evil, and man has to live under God's authority. So that was forbidden to him. Man is not content to have that forbidden to him. He wants to decide what is good and evil. He wants to be the arbiter of these things. And so that's the test that is placed there. God gives the world which he has created to man. But he places this limit, because, as I mentioned earlier, if man was completely free of God and could do absolutely what he liked, that would not be compatible with the fact that he was made in God's image. Man's growth in loyalty to God is going to involve discipline, decision, it's going to involve self-denial, and it involves that for us too. Even Jesus Christ, it said, he learned obedience by the things that he suffered. It doesn't mean to say Jesus was imperfect or that he sinned, but he grew in his development and his relationship with God when he was here upon the earth through the sufferings which he endured. This was teaching him in practical everyday experience the richness of communion and fellowship with God. And this is the same with us. Our maturity, our growth, is going to come as we deny ourselves certain things and as we obey God. At the end of Hebrews chapter 5, it tells us that the mature are those people who, by practice, learn to refuse the evil and choose the good. Now, as we refuse the evil and choose the good, so we develop. Here again, as man had have refused the thing that was forbidden to him and chosen the things that were allowable to him, he would have grown in his fellowship with God, he would have had his inner life deepened, and he would have matured. He would have grown out of this state of childlike innocence into a state of adult maturity. So all of it's there, isn't it, for the growth and development of man. That's what's there in chapter 2. Now when we come to chapter 3, we find how sadly man fails. Just before we do that, it's a reference to the last half a dozen verses of chapter 2, where it talks about the creation of Eve. We find that man found no counterpart among the other animals. He found no response because they were not on the same level as he. They were not made in the image of God. And then one morning he woke up and found this woman standing there. And he said, "At last, one of my own, on my own level, one as his counterpart, one as his companion, one with whom he could enjoy social, physical, spiritual unity, one with whom he could feel that oneness." And so he said in verse 23, "At last, this one, bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh." Then you come to chapter 3, and here we now find how Satan tempts man and how man sins. Notice in verse 3, "The serpent was more subtle than any other wild creature that the Lord God had made." Just an aside here. Notice that it's a wild animal. Wild animals existed before the fall. We're told it here. Man has not yet sinned, and yet wild animals are already there. And I think there's no doubt whatever that death existed before the fall. It's the death of man that is the result of the fall, not death in general. This is in keeping with what we saw earlier, that the whole of the presentation here is as it concerns man. For example, this entrance of sin into the world is the beginning of human sin. It's not the beginning of sin itself. Evil existed before this. Satan existed before man did. The origins of evil, this is something that we don't know. God has not revealed to us the mystery of the origin of evil. What he has revealed to us is the origin of human evil. And so, as we saw earlier, the whole of this presentation in the opening chapters of Genesis is not given to answer all our philosophical questions concerning anything you can think about. It's concerned to show us things we need to know about the origins of man and about the origins of man's sin and the origins of man's death. If Adam and Eve were picking fruit before they sinned, well, obviously there was vegetable death and fruit was getting ripe. And once it's picked, of course, it's cut off from its source of life, and ripe fruit falls to the ground and leaves fall off trees and birds eat worms and anteaters ate ants, and so it goes on. That was the way the world was. I don't think I have to labour that point. But now we come to this issue of man's sin, the origin of human evil. Well, the snake comes along in this story and he tempts man to exceed the limit God has placed. Man has the ability to know God. I touched on this at the very end of my first study. Because man has the ability to know God, he has a capacity for the eternal. There is, you might say, no limit in man's capacity, because if he is made to reach after God, he is made to reach after the eternal. And I saw that the tragedy was when man replaces God with something else, then he becomes an extremist in the worst sense, one way or the other. Because man has this ability to know God, his desires are unlimited. That is not the same of any other animal, because other animals are not made in the image of God. But man is made in the image of God. He has the ability to know God. So what's the temptation? The temptation then is that you want to be like God, not content to remain in the state of subjection to God's authority. Man transgresses the limit and falls into sin. You know the story of the eating of the fruit of the trees and the like. You see the progression here. How, first of all, the devil puts doubt into the mind of the person. Did God really say? And so first the seeds of doubt. The next step, man ceases to trust God fully. Next thing, he wants to be God. Verse 5. You shall be like God, knowing good and evil. And that's what man wants. And that's what the people in the world today, and ever since the beginning, have wanted. They do not want to be under God's authority. They do not want God to tell them what is right and wrong. They want to be God of their own lives, and they want to decide what is right and what is wrong. Man wants to rule his own life. He wants to be the one who determines good and evil. He wants to foresee the future. He wants to be the center of the world. And so he transgresses the limit and falls into sin. And this great historical event took place at the beginning of human history. It's been repeated countless times ever since. And sin is in the world because of this original fall of man from a state of original righteousness to one of sin. Well, we find then that once man has fallen, he becomes conscious of good and evil, but not in the way that he thought. The eyes of them in verse 7, the eyes of them both were opened. They wanted this knowledge of good and evil, and in a sense they got the knowledge of good and evil, but not quite the way they wanted. They wanted to be like God, but the knowledge of good and evil that man has is not the same knowledge of good and evil that God has. God knows good and evil from one who is outside, who is the supreme ruler, and he is not himself affected by evil, because he is holy and just and true. Man knows the difference of good and evil because he himself is affected by evil. Let me give you a very simple illustration. Take a doctor and a patient. The patient will say is dying of some terrible disease, some frightfully painful and horrible disease is eating away at his body. Now the doctor, in my illustration, answers to God, and the patient answers to us. The doctor knows the difference between a healthy body and an unhealthy body, and the patient knows the difference between a healthy body and an unhealthy body. But you see the difference in the knowledge. The doctor is one who is outside, and he looks and he knows what's going on here, and he can make examinations and do investigations, and he knows the difference between the good and the evil, between the good health and the bad health. The patient himself also knows the difference, but what a terrible way to find out. There's the person stricken with disease and suffering and all the rest. He knows, but from a standpoint which brings nothing but sorrow and suffering. Now that's the way it is with man. Man found out the difference between good and evil the hard way. He didn't find out in the sense that he was going to be the supreme God as he hoped, and he found that evil is indeed something ruinous. So there it is, a real twist, isn't it? It's very ironical that man wanted to be like God. He wanted to know the difference between good and evil. He found out, but not in the way that he expected. So we find now that disharmony descends upon the whole scene. Originally, man was in a state of harmony with his environment, his physical environment there in the garden. But now there's disharmony. And in verse 18, we find thorns and thistles enter. So instead of paradise spreading out from the garden to subdue the world, as God had intended in chapter 1, verse 28, the rest of the creation now moves in and wrecks the paradise in the garden. So there's disharmony now with the natural world. We find this disharmony now with his fellow man. The communion he had with his wife, the ecstasy that he experienced when he first found this one that was his equal and his counterpart, the one with whom he could find all the fulfillments which he as a person wanted to find, that harmony is wrecked. And as you know the story very well, when God questions him, he blames his wife, the wife blames the snake, and there's tension between them. As you get down to verse 16, the latter part of verse 16, you find that the original order which God placed in creation is now to be distorted. And the man, instead of exercising his authority in a capacity of one who is equal, now decides that he's going to dominate the woman. And so there again, this tension between the sexes, this male domination which has been such an evil and which hasn't yet been eradicated, this is again a distortion. It's a result of the fall. Certainly men have some responsibilities that women don't have. Women have some responsibilities that men don't have. The two sexes are obviously different physically, emotionally, psychologically, because this is part of God's way of creating a harmonious community. But now sin enters and spoils it. And so you find now that Adam is going to treat his wife as a second-class human. He's going to rule over her and so on. So these are some of the distortions that creep in, and they have ruined human society ever since. So there's harmony between people. There's disharmony between people. And there's disharmony also within the man himself and the woman. Verse 7, they have guilty consciences, so they make themselves clothes. And no longer is man at peace with himself. And finally, there's disharmony with God. And man, instead of looking for God, runs away from God. Instead of seeking communion with God, he goes and hides himself. These then are indications of the failures. God put man in this garden for the training of his physical, mental, social, spiritual appetites. Man fouled it all up. And now you have, instead of harmony, disharmony with the natural world, with one another, within himself, and above all, with God. And so henceforth, life is to be lived and to be reproduced only amid sin and suffering. And so it has been ever since. The woman, it says here in verse 16, is going to give birth to children amid much pain. In verse 17, verse 18, verse 19, it tells us that man now is going to have to earn his living by the sweat of his brow. Verse 19, in the sweat of your face you shall eat bread. In verse 17, second half, cursed is the ground because of you, in toil you shall eat of it all the days of your life. The question has arisen concerning these matters that surely if you're going to work, it was going to involve pain anyway. And surely if women were to give birth to children, it was going to involve pain anyway. How did these things result from the fall? The same concerning death. You might say, well, the way the human frame is constructed, death is just a natural consequence anyway. And if people didn't die, go on living forever and ever and ever, the world would soon get frightfully overpopulated. These problems sometimes occur to people. Just let's point out one or two things. The penalty of sin was death. It doesn't mean to say that if people hadn't sinned, they would have lived forever. There may have been some way God had of bringing earthly existence to an end without death. It is not the termination of human earthly existence which is the consequence of sin. It is death which is the consequence of sin. And it's death which makes the termination of our present existence such a fearful thing to us. Now God has shown us that he may bring earthly existence to an end without death in the case of Enoch and Elijah. Also in the case of Christians who are living at the return of Christ, their earthly existence in its present form will come to an end without death. So God may have been able to remove people when he thought they had lived long enough without death. It is death that is the consequence of sin. And death is fearful because sin is the sting of death. I think that problem is reasonably well answered. Now C.S. Lewis in one of his books has proposed an interesting theory. This is simply a suggestion, but it strikes me as being very sensible, which explains some of these problems. The suggestion is this, that when man was living perfectly in right relationship with God, the higher parts of his nature, the spiritual parts of his nature, you might say, because they were in perfect condition, had complete control over everything else, so that ordinary physical functions would have been able to be performed without pain. It is not childbirth which is the result of sin. It is the pain that comes through childbirth. It is not work that is the result of sin. It's the pain that comes through work. It's not the cessation of earthly existence which is the result of sin. It's the death which produces that cessation of earthly existence. Now, if a person was living in this perfect relationship with God, the higher parts of his nature would have had such control over the lower parts of his nature that he could have worked, or she could have given birth to children without the accompanying pain. But once man sinned, the higher parts of his nature lost that control over the lower parts of his nature, and so things just took their natural course. The natural tendencies within the human frame, you might say, towards decay would not have taken place as long as man lived in his right relationship with God. But once he broke that relationship, well, then the natural tendencies towards decay just followed the natural course, and in due time, so death took place. And likewise, these physical functions, such as work or childbirth, as the case may be, which otherwise may have been accomplished pleasingly and without pain, now, because man had lost the control which God originally gave him, now these things had the pain associated with them which we're so familiar with. That's just by the way. You won't get any chapter and verse to prove all that I've just been saying, but it strikes me as being a very sensible explanation, because I know these questions do arise in people's minds. How are these things a result of sin, when just to look at your own bodies, it appears to you that they are going to happen anyway? But I think that is probably a reasonable explanation. We now find that God confirmed all the choices man made, and that is something we must always bear in mind. God has placed us here, he's given us the alternatives of obedience and disobedience, and we make the decision, we bear the consequences, and God confirms it. God doesn't twist our arm. Man rejected eternal life, so God confirmed it. Verse 24, he withheld the tree of life from man. Secondly, man wanted to be independent of God. Okay, says God, you can't be independent. I'll turn you loose. Out you go, out from the garden into the wild world outside. And thirdly, you want to know good and evil? All right, says God, you will know good and evil the hard way, out in the world where there's nothing but conflict and fighting and squabbling and suffering and turmoil, all of which are the result of your sin. And so God confirms the choices we make. Not to be taken lightly, all this stuff. Now, just before I leave chapter 3, one comment here on verses 14 and 15. I've discussed very briefly the curse upon the woman. I've discussed also the curse upon the man. Just a look in verses 14 and 15 at the curse upon the snake. Because you have done this, cursed are you above all cattle and above all wild animals. Upon your belly you shall go, dust you shall eat all the days of your life. I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your seed and her seed. He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel. We don't want to get into an argument here over whether snakes had legs or not. I think that's a rather silly sort of a thing to introduce. Obviously, it's a snake, it's a snake. All that God is saying here is that the snake slithering, gliding, and wriggling away in the dust, that is going to be a fitting symbol of the humility which the snake deserved because of its trickery in what it had done to the woman and the man. The important point here is in verse 16. You might say that the first line simply means that women don't like snakes, and snakes don't like women. Well, I guess that's a fairly obvious thing to say. But the more important thing is in the second line. It's not only that Eve is not going to get on well with a snake, but Eve's descendants are not going to get on well with the snake's descendants. Now, this is all very pictorial here, and I don't know if it's ever occurred to us that we're nowhere told in the book of Genesis that the snake represents Satan. In fact, we're not even told in the Old Testament at all. We're told that when we get to the New Testament, but I guess people would have worked it out, that the snake was symbolic of Satan. So there's going to be conflict between Satan and the human race, mankind. We know that a man can kill a snake. We know that a snake can bite a man. A snake can bite a man's heel, and a man can tread on a snake's head and kill it. So there's going to be conflict in which Satan is looking as if he's going to get the better of mankind because he's biting mankind's heels all the time. But eventually, mankind will crush his head. So that although the snake has won the first victory, he's not going to win the last. He has got the better of man for the time being, but eventually man will get the better of him. And man does get the better of Satan in the person of Jesus Christ. Christ became a man, and so it's Christ who then becomes the one through whom mankind is victorious. Adam was the one through whom mankind fell, but now Christ comes as the head of a new race, and through him Satan is conquered. Satan persecutes Christ, he afflicts Christ, and there is suffering, but Christ in the end triumphs. Even Jesus suffering on the cross, you can see there something of the work of Satan using wicked men to treat him as they did. But Satan didn't win. Jesus won because he rose from the dead. And so although Satan bit his heel, Christ crushed his head. So here, I think in this verse, we have one of the very early anticipations of the great drama of redemption which came to its climax in Jesus Christ. Very quickly now onto chapter 4. Adam and Eve now have two boys, Cain and Abel. We know the story of how Cain made an offering of agricultural products, and his offering was accepted. Cain made an offering, I'll say that again, Cain made an offering of agricultural products, that's right, and his offering was accepted. Abel made an offering of a lamb from his flock, and his offering was not accepted. And people say, why was it that Abel's was accepted and Cain's was not? Have I got that wrong again?
Yeah.
Right. Well, I'm glad you're all awake. I don't have to say it again now because you've worked it out. Why was it that Abel's was accepted and Cain's was not? And people say, Abel's was accepted because it involved the shedding of blood. Cain's was not accepted because it did not involve the shedding of blood. I don't think that's right at all. Certainly, as we look at the New Testament, you may see more significance in a blood sacrifice than in a non-blood sacrifice. But that is nowhere told us in the Bible as the reason why Abel's offering was accepted and Cain's was not. The reason is given, well, in verse 4 it says, "The Lord had regard to Abel and his offering. The Lord had no regard to Cain and his offering, the man before his offering." It was the man that was wrong, it was the man that was right. And the Bible is very consistent in telling us that no matter what offering a person offered, if he himself was wrong, his offering was not acceptable. Even if it was an offering of lambs or goats, if the person was bad, God would not accept his offering. God doesn't like hypocrites. Now this is confirmed when you come to the New Testament, and it tells us that Abel was a man of faith, and God accepted him. Cain was arrogant, and God didn't accept him. More specifically, in 1 John chapter 3, it tells us that Cain was an evil man. He was of the evil one. Abel was of God. We are told that Cain's deeds were evil. Abel's deeds were righteous. That's why God accepted Abel's offering, because the man himself was a man of faith and a godly person. God did not accept Cain's offering because he was the opposite. Even if Cain had have offered a lamb from the flock, he would still not have been accepted, because Cain was a bad man. I think we can see the lesson for us here, that all our religious exercises are not going to be acceptable to God if we, in our behaviour, are wrong people. It's the person that God is concerned with before the sacrifices he makes. Now, if Cain wanted to be accepted, what he had to do was not go along and offer an animal from the flock. What he had to do was repent of his evil deeds, as God says here in verse 7. If you do well, will you not be accepted? In other words, if you repent and change your ways from evil deeds to righteous deeds, well, then you'll be accepted. But if you do not do well, sin is couching at the door. Its desire is for you, but you must master it. In other words, he's saying, sin is there like a wild beast waiting to pounce upon you and destroy you. Now you must master it, because if you don't master it, it will master you. That's the way it is with all of us. Habits, temptations, sin, waiting there like a wild beast to destroy us. We've got to master those things, because if we don't get the better of them, very soon they'll get the better of us. Well, Cain did not take the advice, and we find that sin did master him. His jealousy increased, and jealousy is at the root of most of the evils that seem to be perpetrated in this world. Jealousy got the better of him. He did not master his sin, and he murdered his brother. Because he murdered his brother, there had to be retribution. We find in verse 10 that Abel's blood cries from the ground, and normally the life of the murderer is forfeit because he has taken the life of someone else. In this case, we find that God's justice is mixed with mercy, something which we're going to see time and again through our studies, and God banishes Cain from the place here where men at least still worshipped God. But in verses 8 to 16, we find that Cain is driven out from the presence of the Lord. Now that was his own desire. He didn't want God, so God confirmed it. All right, says God, you don't want me, out you go. You don't have to have me. And so he's banished. But again we find God in his grace offers protection when Cain pleads for mercy. He said, if anybody finds me, they'll murder me because of what I have done. So in verse 15, God says, not so. I'll mark you out in some particular way so that you are not murdered. And if anybody does murder you, well then I will reimburse him sevenfold. So Cain continued to live. And from verse 17, to verse 24, you have then a record of how the descendants of Cain developed over the next many, many generations. Now, there are many, many names put here. The people in those days lived a long time, so from verse 17 through to verse 24 covers hundreds, probably thousands of years as the descendants of Cain multiplied. Now, the story is not going to be concerned with the descendants of Cain. It's going to be concerned rather with the descendants of Seth, who was the child born to Adam and Eve to replace the murdered Abel. But first of all, to deal with the descendants of Cain. Cain is driven from the presence of the Lord, and now he sets out to make some sort of success of his independence. And we have now the beginnings of civilized life. He builds himself in verse 17 some sort of local settlement. And as you go on through his various descendants, generation after generation, you find further developments in the history of early man. This is because man was made in the image of God, and he is now starting to realize some of his potentialities. In verse 20, you notice that we have here a man who is the father of all those who dwell in tents and have cattle, the beginning of a sort of nomadic type of existence. That's an advance on Abel's small pastoral interests. And then in verse 21, we have a man who was the father of all those who play the lyre and the pipe, so you have music now being common. In verse 22, we have a further development in the crafts and metalwork, with a person who is the forger of all instruments of bronze and iron. And you can see how man is developing. Back in the Garden of Eden, he was eating berries off trees. He was eating fruit that he could pick. A little later on, he's looking after animals with Abel. Now he's starting to move around over a wider area with cattle. Then he's developing music and poetry and songs and craftsmanship and metalwork. And so the development of mankind goes on. But you notice that wherever man develops, instead of using these things to glorify God, he uses them to glorify himself and fight against God. And it's still going on today. Man is continuing to develop, but instead of dedicating these things to God, he uses them for his own glorification and to fight against God. And you have that here in this man Lamech. He tries to improve upon God's ideal of one man, one wife. In verse 19, he takes two wives. Cain had murdered Abel in a fit of jealousy. Lamech killed a young boy for no other reason than that the boy punched him. Not only that, but he made up a song to celebrate his murder. Verse 23, he said to his two wives, "Listen to my voice. I have slain a man for wounding me, a young man for striking me." Just that. "I've killed him for it. Aren't I clever?" And now he challenges anybody to take revenge against him. If anybody killed Cain, God was going to avenge that death sevenfold. "You try killing me. Anybody who kills me will get it 77-fold. And on that note of bravado, the line of Cain disappears from the scene. The last two verses tell us now that the godly line was to be preserved through Seth. Now, if you look back over those previous few verses, you'll find that the human race now has populated itself over many generations. Lots of names there I haven't gone into. But it now numbers probably thousands, tens of thousands. And they don't know God. Those who did know God were a very small minority. And that line is going to be perpetuated through Seth, one of the other sons born to Adam and Eve. And it's that line that we'll follow when we take up the story in chapter 5 and the chapters which follow tomorrow morning.